Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart Mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store or Lowe's.com for more details.
Astonishing Legends Network.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts and listeners on the Astonishing Dead Letter Office are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Astonishing Legends Productions, the Astonishing Legends Network, or any affiliated entities or guests.
When something unexplainable happens to you, it can make you feel isolated or alone. But trust us, you're not. For over a decade, you've been sending your strange stories to Astonishing Legends. And now it's time for our fellow Legenders to hear them too. Join us weekly in Blanket Fortiana as we dig through your intriguing messages to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
Tonight's episode, The Inn at Fox Mill.
Well, tonight we're headed up into the far western corner of Maryland. Cumberland, actually, right? Where the state pinches down to a thin neck between Pennsylvania and West Virginia.
Yeah, and I believe George Washington's first headquarters were around there, right?
Yeah, had to do a little research on this, but Fort Cumberland was there before there was a Cumberland, which is where General Edward Braddock launched his march on the French in 1755 with a young George Washington riding along as one of his aides. But that whole thing was a disaster. Braddock actually got killed, and Washington more or less held the retreat together. But they staged out of this particular spot. And by the 1800s, it was a boom town. The National Road, as they call it, runs right through it, the B&O Railroad, which I opined a long time ago about being my first model railroad on a ton of episodes of our show. Mm-hmm. And the C&O Canal, both dead end there. So coal, iron, glass, brewing, all that stuff. So for a while, it was the second biggest city in Maryland. They called it the Queen City, which is also what they call Charlotte here in North Carolina.
Right. The secret lies with Charlotte. Well, that battle, I believe, where George Washington had to take over and lead the retreat, is featured in the new George Washington movie or series that's coming out.
Oh, that's cool. I want to see that.
There's a lot of things like, it's just miraculous. His story is miraculous anyway.
Yeah.
But just weird things happen in battle, which we're going to find out. And this area that we're talking about, this was also part of the Civil War.
That's right. The war came right up to the edge of town. There was actually an engagement, which Chris talks about in the letter tonight, on the east side of Cumberland in the summer of 1864. Artillery, the whole thing. They fought practically in people's front yards. Some of the locations are still standing, and a few of them, as is the case in a lot of places, are restaurants now, because that's what happens.
That's always the best fate for a historic place, is to serve good food and brew.
Yes, you can sit in there and imagine what it was like in the days of yore.
Yeah, no, I do love seeing, again, buildings being repurposed and kept alive rather than just going to rot, because so many haunted places we check out are trying to be saved, but cost a lot of private money.
Yes.
So not an easy thing to do. So I'm glad to see some commerce going on. And in this case, there's a building on the east side of town, just off the interstate, that's been a lot of things over the years. And our listener and author for tonight's story, Chris, didn't just eat there. He worked there as the brewmaster. So there was a lot of late nights, and after the doors were locked, that's the kind of work shift and location that a lot of Dead Letters originate from. So there's a lot of things that we recognize. And I'm sure a lot of people who've worked in historic places that became something else, and especially restaurants, you're there after hours. And I'm sure a lot of things happen. That's a very common trope, I guess. Yeah, these are the hours where, you know, the activity dies down, the place stops being a restaurant, and maybe it goes back to being whatever it was in the past, because this is my other thought, too. It's like Waverly, one of the most haunted locations in the world, when they have their massive Halloween party there with, you know, thousands of people, I'm sure these spirits just take a vacation because it's like no one's going to hear or see anything crazy that they're trying to do. It's just part of it. So it gets drowned out. But when it's quiet, that's when things happen.
Well, the specifics of this letter are worth hearing cold, so we're going to leave them for the story itself. Long story, not so short. One night after close, someone let Chris and the other folks he was hanging out with know that they weren't the only ones in the building. They were just the most recent arrivals. Forrest, I believe the letter is yours tonight.
I adore your program. I crave long-form detailed stories that are experience-based. It really hits the spot, especially the multi-part episodes. It's clear Astonishing Legends is meticulous with the research and the presentation, and it's obvious you both are passionate about these fringe topics after so much time in the podcast game. That's why I think this will resonate with you guys. The following story is true and not your average paranormal chaff. This all happened back in 2003 or 2004 in an old building on the east side of Cumberland, Maryland, right off I-68. Today, it's an Italian restaurant. Back then, it was split between two different concepts, a pizzeria with a microbrewery in the basement, and they brewed some of the best beer I've ever had. And I'm not just saying that because I was the head brewer. And upstairs, on the main floor, a colonial-style restaurant called The Inn at Folk's Mill. The menu was fascinating in concept, dishes inspired and recreated from 250-year-old recipes. Good food, genuinely interesting. Just not a hit. Happy hour was always packed. But before any of that matters, you need to understand what that building is. It's old. Pre-Civil War old. During the war, it served as a field hospital. The attic housed soldiers suffering from shell shock. Their sketches are still on the walls up there, drawn by the soldiers themselves. The bedroom floor was recovery, now offices and dining space. The main floor was triage, where amputations were performed. And the basement, where my story takes place, was the morgue. The coldest part of the building. That's where they kept the bodies of the slain. The place was haunted. And I say that as a skeptic, someone genuinely curious about high strangeness, but not quick to believe. Haunted, no question. I'd watched faucets turn on full blast with nobody near them. Seen boxes of straws launch themselves off shelves. Watched mugs leap from the grooved trays designed to hold them in place. Things I wouldn't believe if anyone told me. The building had a presence you could feel the moment you walked in. The local paranormal society visited the attic every fall with their ghost hunting gear, but the weirdest things, like always, happened in the basement. So, one night, closing time, four of us, me, a server, a bartender, and the manager. The restaurant closed at 10, the bar at 11. After that, we stayed a while, like most nights, sitting in the basement bar drinking Scottish ale, smoking, listening to music, just unwinding. Then it happened. The loudest sound I have ever heard in my life. Picture someone lifting a 500-pound commercial refrigerator and slamming it into the wooden floorboards 2 feet above your head. That's the closest I can get to explain the sound. Dust fell down from the ceiling. The bottles behind the bar shook so violently, the bartender threw both arms out to steady them. The wine glasses above me rattled like they were about to shatter. It was deafening. It shook the entire building. Or so it seemed. We ran upstairs immediately. My first thought, the brand new wine cabinet had toppled. Which was impossible. I mean, it was massive. We hit every light, searched every room. Nothing. Not one chair out of place. No broken glass. No fallen furniture. No evidence of anything. Just silence. And four people staring at each other trying to make sense of a crash that had no source. We went back downstairs, shaken, and started trading ghost stories the way you do when you have no better explanation. That's when the phone rang. The business line. We looked at the caller ID. The call was coming from inside the building. I understand how cliche this sounds, but it was from the owner's office, upstairs. The owner was Ed Mason, a retired Maryland state senator in his 70s. There was simply no version of events where this man was awake at midnight, let alone slipping into his office undetected on a weekday. He was obsessive about security. Nobody had a key to that office but him. The building was locked. We were the only people inside. We didn't answer. We walked straight out the door. No cars in the parking lot, but the ones we were running towards to get us out of there. Over the next few months, I told that story often. My coworkers did too. Then one day I was telling it again when the owner's wife, Jane, happened to overhear. She was in her 70s, and this building had actually been her childhood home, long before it became a restaurant. She listened to the whole thing. Then she said, calm as anything, "Oh, that was the cannonball." I stared at her. "The what?" "The cannonball. This building was struck by a cannonball during the Civil War, right where Ed's office is now. When I was growing up, it happened sometimes. We'd be sitting down to dinner or out in the backyard, and suddenly, boom, that exact sound. It happened often enough that we stopped rushing to check. We just knew what it was." Of course, I chuckled like she was pulling my leg. Then she told us some other stories about the house that I can't remember enough to retell. Standard haunted house stuff. But I could tell she was serious about all of it. I've thought about that night a lot over the years. We didn't just hear a ghost. We were there the night history replayed itself. The night that building got hit by a cannonball all over again. If you're curious, you can still visit. It's an Italian restaurant now. Ask nicely, and they may let you up into the attic to see the soldiers' drawings. But I'll tell you this. Every time I think about that sound, I'm reminded that we weren't just standing in a haunted building. We were standing in a place where the past still lives. So researching the past events of this building, I learned that this building wasn't just on the sidelines. There was in fact a battle that took place there, like right there, and named after the property the building is on. For our listeners, this research content sounds as though our listener did some AI research here. This is not our personal research, but we're sharing it as part of the original dead letter as it was sent in. The Battle of Foulke's Mill, also known as the Battle of Cumberland, was fought on August 1, 1864, as part of the Valley Campaigns of the Civil War. Confederate cavalry under Generals John McCausland and Bradley T. Johnson had just finished burning Chambersburg, Pennsylvania 2 days earlier and were pushing toward Cumberland to disrupt the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad and demand a ransom from the town, or burn it too. Union General Benjamin F. Kelly positioned his troops on a series of hills northeast of Cumberland overlooking Evitt's Creek, right where the Foulke family's grist and sawmills stood. The Foulke property became the center of the skirmish. Confederate troops actually took shelter behind the mill structures while under Union fire from the hillside above. Here's the part directly relevant to your experience. The dwelling, mill, and barn of John Foulke were squarely in range of the Union guns and were struck multiple times by the shells. The barn was set ablaze by an exploding shell and burned completely. So, artillery rounds were absolutely flying through that area and hitting buildings. The fight began around 3 p.m. and lasted 4.5 hours. With Union forces holding firm in front and another Federal force pressing their rear, the Confederates had no choice but to slip away under the cover of darkness, leaving campfires burning to fool the Federals. Confederate losses were 2 killed, 2 wounded, and 3 captured. The Federals suffered 12 wounded. Though tactically inconclusive, Kelly's stand likely saved Cumberland from being burned. The Foulke's Mill site was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2008. So the building was right in the thick of it. Artillery exchange, shells hitting nearby structures,
a field hospital processing the aftermath. The cannonball that hit Ed's office wasn't some stray accident. The building was in the middle of an active engagement. Chris sent the sources he used in as well, which are in the show notes. If you made it this far, and I'm pretty sure you did, I grant you permission to use any of this on your podcast, should you find a spot to share it. Maybe a dead letter office. Regardless, I hope you find this weird and fascinating, and I'd love to hear what you come up with. Your perspective is always appreciated.
Something strange is going on in Blanket Fortiana tonight. We'll return in moments. Back to tonight's dead letter.
Wow, that is such an amazing story. And I think my favorite detail about it is the physical residue from the sound. Not just that they all heard it, not that one person heard it and others didn't. They all heard it, but then on top of that, the building was rattling.
Well, that brings up a majorly interesting and pertinent question here, because Chris himself was pondering and kind of asking us, like, well, I want to hear your take on it. What do you think's going on here?
Right.
And we've certainly heard a lot of this. And so it wasn't, you know, the moaning with the chains.
Right.
The shout of the clanking of armor and battle and muskets being fired, muzzle loading, smoothbore rifles and all.
Yeah.
And that's a different thing. People have, of course, often heard that, where when it comes to battle, because, sadly, so much of human history is about wars and people fighting each other, people will have reported in historical locations the sounds of horses clopping down cobblestone streets and the clanking of armor and swords.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of that here in a minute. That's right.
Yeah, and so there's a process that's going on here, because while not in a battle, will people hear men shouting in, sounds like old-timey, olden days language, and the clanking of armor and shouting of orders and such with the horses, it still made some kind of an imprint. And so the question here is that, is this part of a ghost or spirit action, or is this something, let's say, not as much supernatural, but paranormal in the sense that it's trapped sound, a la Stone Tape Theory kind of thing, where the firing and impact of a cannonball is very loud and it shakes stuff. And so when that sound hits, of course, there's no damage, but there's something about that which may be akin to a spirit knocking or scratching, footprints, all that kind of stuff. When you can hear it and there's a little bit of shaking, sound is a vibration. It's a frequency. It's impacting the air around it to make the sound that you can actually hear rather than just feel the vibration of the floor. I love that dust was falling between the cracks of the floorboards. That just is a very evocative detail to this story.
Yeah, you could just feel it. And like the bartender putting both his arms out to keep stuff from falling off the shelves. Like, it's so physical.
Yeah, exactly. But what's going on here? So when you have that sound getting replayed, let's say it is something that's paranormal and just, you know, a more natural, I guess, part of just existence in this reality on Earth, apart a little bit from spirit and how they interact. It's the other stuff that he described, like the mugs being knocked off the tray meant to hold mugs in place, things moving on their own, I guess straws falling off the shelf by themselves. That may be something different. That might be spirit activity in a poltergeist form. You know what I'm saying? Somebody's just looking at stuff, maybe playing a joke, maybe just looking at it like, oh, what's this box here? Oh, it's 1,000 straws, which I just dumped on the floor. I'm sorry, but you'll clean that up, right? You know, like I said, I don't know the motivations, but stuff gets moved around. And again, we just had a DLO talking about that. This is something different where, it is something maybe imprinted like horses coming down the cobblestone streets. It's just a very significant sound, remarkable at the time, and gets replayed occasionally, like released from the atmosphere. Somehow it's just trapped in a loop. But also along with just that sound of an impact creating compression waves, which, you know, get to your ears and turns into sound you hear with your brain, there's force with it. You know, there's a concussion. There's a bit of a shock wave that happens. And so I'm really fascinated by that process of just a sound appearing. Like, where does it get stored exactly? Is it replaying in some plane or level of existence And what triggers it to be released? Like an earthquake, pressure builds up eventually and somehow it just kind of snaps open and that gets replayed as a, let's say, an audio file on an SD card and just gets replayed whenever something happens or it's quiet.
Yeah.
Does that ever happen when it's full of people in the restaurant?
Yeah.
I'm curious to know about that because that's going to cause a ruckus.
Right.
So is it just the right conditions that gets that audio to be released as a cannonball hitting? And when it does, obviously something's affecting our frequency of existence, let's say, to cause the shockwave to rattle the glasses and the bottles falling, shaking, the dust falling down, the building shaking. So something is also affecting that. And so that's the very real part of this. And what I like about this story too is that for those that may not believe in spirit or afterlife, you might more readily believe this because this sounds like an effect, but it's a very mysterious and spooky effect, but everybody saw it. So there's a lot of witnesses. It's not a spirit of somebody that passed there, but obviously I believe that that's very likely. The place is chock full of spirits. But this is just a phenomenon that's happening that's a part of the ghost experience, but also its own thing.
There are some folks that might think this, because this is or was coal country, but some research that we've done indicated that by this time, that was almost completely wound down. It was just maybe 100, 150 men working spread out in different areas. And the closest one to here was, I think, 10 or 20 miles away. And that's permitted daytime work. It's not something that would happen at night. So if anybody's like, oh, well, maybe it was residual, you know, what kind of work would you do even if it wasn't mining? Let's say, oh, they're building a highway. They're blasting a pass through this X, Y, or Z, or they're working on train tracks or whatever. You're never going to do the blasting in the middle of the night. Just not going to happen. So
no, and you're going to listen. You're upsetting a lot of people.
Yes,
you're going to wake them up. Like I said, this is late at night. So as they say, it's like they can't imagine a scenario where the owner, who's in his 70s, would come down to the restaurant, sneak in to get to his office,
right,
and somehow knock over a safe, literally on the floor, to make that kind of noise. So this is what I like about lockdowns. You know, so when you go ghost hunting, that's what you want.
Right.
You want the place locked. You don't want anybody to come in. You don't want any stragglers or people doing work because then you can't rule that out.
Right,
so
right.
When you know it's only you folks there, that really helps in the investigation. And man, that would be a fantastic place to ghost hunt.
Yeah.
Now I'm convinced there's two types of things that are unusual going on. So you have these kind of stone tape type trapped sounds. And also, we're going to talk, I see our notes here, and I made some thoughts down too, about strange things that happen in battle, but specifically like the Civil War. And I don't know if they're in your notes section, but the strange phenomenon of acoustics in these valley battles, where it was reported during the Civil War, there could be a battle going on. I'm talking, you know, full thing, artillery, muskets, shouting, sabers, cavalry charges, the whole thing going on a mile or less maybe away from other townsfolk. And because of the acoustics in the hills and other various environmental conditions, people didn't even hear it. They didn't even know there was a battle going on.
Right, right. Oh, that's interesting.
Otherwise, it would be so loud. Yeah, I mean, obviously, just a mile away, you're going to hear cannons. I could hear idiots lighting off M100s, you know, like blocks from me. So, and that's, I know, at least a couple miles away. And here, it's just a weird phenomenon about acoustics. The other thing is that a lot of weird stuff also went on during the Civil War where people sometimes treated it as a spectacle, you know, where they would get on the hill and have a picnic as a battle was raging in the valley below.
Oh, interesting.
They didn't have TV or streaming, so that was the entertainment. And it was kind of a weird attitude of sorts, but also, obviously, all battles are horribly vicious, but this one, especially because you have, as folks know, students of history, you started to have some mechanization to it, and it gets extra bloody. And so you have a lot of injuries, but yeah, just this fact here of two, of course, you have the Revolutionary War era and a lot of tragedy happening and misery and pain. And then again, in the Civil War, you have layers of this human experience piled on. And it's just a very rich spot. I think probably something about that parcel of land has the right conditions to present that kind of stuff.
So from what we could dig up, and this pretty much aligns with what Chris was saying in the story, General Benjamin Kelly put two sections of artillery up on the hill, Battery L of the 1st Illinois Light Artillery. So the building that Chris worked in was a Union gun position on the 1st of August in 1864. And that same house that he was working in took the wounded. It did two jobs in one afternoon. It was firing out and it was taking fire.
Yeah. So in the scenario here, the second Kelly's guns open up, General McCausland brings his own artillery forward to fire back.
Right.
Counter battery fire is just you trying to knock out the other guns that are hitting you, right?
Yes. So you're,
because you, right, muskets, it's too far for musket fire. So you're volleying shots back and forth as fast as you can load just to knock out the other artillery.
Scary.
Yeah, so that's what's happening here, and it is scary. But traditionally, the tactical advantage goes to those who are higher in a position. So
yeah.
It's hard to fire back up.
Right.
But yeah, guns were in that house. That is true.
Yeah.
So a round coming back at that building, it wouldn't be a freak event or just a misfire or something. That's probably one of the most likely things to happen.
Right. So, and I went digging into the restaurant's own history. And the thing that's documented, not folklore, it's totally documented, is that wounded men were laid up in that attic and they drew on the walls, and the place still walks visitors up to see it. So when Chris says there was a recovery floor, he's not embellishing. There's a physical record. The basement morgue, the amputations on the main floor, the room by room stuff, that's a little harder to confirm these days, but it's totally plausible given what was happening on the top floor. But the hospital, those men up in the attic, that's a verifiably real. That's a true story.
Yeah, so that layout that was described, that tracks for me because I've been fortunate enough to be on some ghost hunts at places that are now historical landmarks where it's a similar scenario. And because that's the usual thing. Think about it. It's like there's a large house. There's a battle going on. The occupying force of the army needs to use that for shelter, for mostly for hospital, treating the wounded and the dead, and just like a general headquarters where they can, they're not under too much fire. But similar thing when I visited Octagon Hall Museum, which I've always wanted to cover. We just never gotten around to it, but that was on, I think, one of my first ghost hunts with Jill and Roger. That is a very famous antebellum landmark in Franklin, Kentucky. Also very involved in the Civil War with a lot of paranormal activity, but same thing.
Is that where you got that SLS footage that we have?
I think there might be some of it,
There's like a sitting room and the SLS camera picks up like a stick figure ghost, like sitting in a chair and like putting it, resting its leg on its knee and the whole nine yards.
That happens several times weirdly.
Okay.
We might do something on that. I know it's not that dramatic to see a stick figure, but that's video overlaid in kind of an augmented reality setting here. But when I first powered up the camera, I just bought it. Like, this thing is cool. Just fun to play with. Let's see what happens. And that was at the DuPont Mansion in Louisville, Kentucky. Uh-huh. And so I just powered it on. I'm like on the second floor of the DuPont Mansion, which is now a B&B. And I open, there's this door. I love opening doors to mysterious things. And I opened the door, but it was weird that it was a false closet of sorts. I'm sure there was some kind of electrical or water utility behind it or how something, for whatever reason, it was walled off. So you open the door and it's only like a foot deep and there's a wall there and it's wallpapered. And I stood back and then I immediately got a small child size stick figure just standing there.
Yes.
Kind of swaying its arms like a little kid. It's like, okay, I could see the argument where people say like, well, you point the SLS camera, it's picking up something like a chair, right? So there's a sloping motion, there's legs.
This is the part where you would have been like, Scott, do you see that? And you would have just heard a car door in the parking lot closing and me like starting the car.
It's a child ghost. Come on, they're harmless.
That's the worst part.
Unless it's the little,
that's the worst part.
The little girl. Okay. So I asked, it's like, well, do you want to play? Like I started
talking.
Let's
talk about the last child ghost I met.
So that was the first time. It's like, okay, this is interesting. It's picking up a stick figure where most people who are trying to debunk the phenomenon will say like, well, yeah, it's picking up something that is human-like. Yeah, again, like a chair, a coat rack, even a jacket hung up. Like it's the shape, so it's trying to mimic that. It's like, there's nothing there. It's a flat wall. But yes, later on down in the partly what was interesting is that there's two chairs by the fireplace hearth, and I had it point at the chair, and it didn't immediately make a stick figure, even though it's a chair with very short, stubby legs. But then suddenly a stick figure pops up like, oh, this is interesting. And it looks like it's sitting in the chair.
Right.
Now, here's the thing about data like that. You can pass it off as just, again, it's just a fluke and the camera's imagining things. But then it'll do something human. And I saw the thing, and it looks like its arms are resting on the armrest of the chair. You can see legs pointing straight down. And then one of the legs crosses.
Yes, that's the clip I meant. And we're going to be showing that at the Wet Hot Bag Magic summer camp we're going to with the Time Suck folks with Dan and Lindsay Cummins.
If we have yes. Here's the thing most folks don't realize about ghost hunting is that you get days and days of data
yeah.
that you have to pour through yeah. and scrutinize every frame. So hopefully it's somewhere. But okay, if it was freaked out by the chair, it's thinking the chair is a person squatting or sitting in midair. The legs shouldn't move, but this did a very human thing where you see the legs cross yeah. and like the arm go up. And I saw one time I saw one like laying down on the couch
yeah.
on a almost couch, like with its coy. Arm propped up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's two like smaller children, and there were children at that
yeah,
house.
So
this is the place where, yeah, I was picking this up, but what I was going to say to that is that they had mannequins dressed up in period clothing in each room, which is creepy in itself. But there you could see sometimes the SLS camera, if you let it sit on the mannequin, you don't get anything. And then a stick figure would overlay on top
right.
of it. So is that just picking up the mannequin and its human shape? Or is there now a spirit inhabiting the mannequin?
That's a good question.
Which is, I was hoping it was the second. Yeah, but in any case, places like this, there was a lot of wounded
yes.
there. And also, I think they ferried underground slaves. It was a...
Sure.
part of the Underground Railroad at some right. point. And you got to see the little hole in the floor where they kind of stuck
oh,
people
cool.
down into
that's
it
cool.
and just hid them until they could be moved out in the
right.
middle of the night. So a lot of cool yeah. history, but yeah, but also a lot of blood, a lot of pain
right.
and screaming and this and that. And so when we get back to this, it's like, I have no doubt most all of those places, but again, I firmly believe there are spirits everywhere, but there's a lot of activity at this place. But getting back to battlefield ghost stories, you know, the best known ghost stories on any battlefield in the state are over at Antietam. And that's a couple of hours east of Cumberland, down near Sharpsburg, Bloody Lane, as it's called, you know, the sunken road where the dead piled
yeah.
up. Oof. People report the smell of gunpowder, phantom gunfire, and then a sound of some of them swear is singing.
Right. And so what's interesting is the day after the battle that is we referenced earlier, August 2nd, that same column hit Old Town down on the Potomac 2 days after they'd burned Chambersburg. So the violence that that building caught was one beat in a raid that was rolling right through that whole stretch of Western Maryland.
Yeah.
And everybody out there grew up on those cannon stories. And that's what's interesting, too, about the senator's
right.
wife, Jane, hearing the explosions all the time. Now, something I do want to point out is like if she was hearing them in the daytime when she was younger because she was in her 70s, it is possible maybe she was hearing something connected to mining. But that is not going to be the case here again at night for Chris and his coworkers.
Yes, and now I've thought about the Wabash Cannonball. Remember,
oh, yeah.
Roy Acuff did that song.
Yes, I remember the song.
Anyway, cannonballs, yes, people remember them. They have great impact, pun intended. But here's the thing, though, and if you've been listening to us for a while, you know this. A battle refighting itself is one of the oldest things in the English language record, right? That's what we're talking about
right.
because it made an impact while folks were alive, and it continues to. And we went down a real rabbit hole on this story. So Edge Hill, 1642, was the first big clash of the English Civil War. And within weeks, travelers and shepherds said they heard and saw the whole thing happen again over the field. The whole thing, drums, cannon, cavalry. There's even a 1643 pamphlet called A Great Wonder in Heaven. And the story there goes that Charles I sent officers out to look into it, this phenomenon,
yeah.
and some of them claimed they recognized men they'd watched die.
Wow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So we're talking about a pamphlet that's 380 years old. I mean, yeah, you're taking that as an account, but as we say, there's often a kernel of truth at the heart of an astonishing legend. And I'll leave you with this. People have to remember this. When they, you know, you'll get people refuting you or say, that's not correct. This was so what happened to so-and-so back in antiquity. And I'm talking about the days of ancient Rome and Greece and famous battles. And you have to always keep in mind, because I just remembered somebody had written us a letter. They were quite upset that we were talking about what the Druids did as practices of beheading and all the kind of the nasty things.
Oh, okay.
That's historically correct, but you have to keep in mind that history was written by one guy.
Yeah, right.
And I can't remember his name. Right. They receive stories coming in from all over the world, soldiers who've done conquests overseas, and all these great stories, and they get passed down, and they try to record as best they can what they heard. But sometimes it's eyewitness, sometimes it's just a relayed story. And this famous ancient historian from antiquity writes it down, and that's all the history we got. Yeah. So every part of history could be questionable because it's come through all these filters. My point being, on the other hand, okay, that's what we got for history, and it may or may not be right, but does it matter? Yes, in some sense, but you'll never find the actual truth.
Right.
You're never going to go back in time and see what really happened. So that's all we got. And so when you argue points like, well, that didn't really happen, it's like, well, that's as best as we know.
Right.
And that's as best as the records were kept at the time, and generally by one historian. And that may have been revised from him over the years by other historians down
that's
the line.
Right.
It's like, I don't think he was right. So I'm going to write it this way.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. There's a lot of cases of that kind of history. And here's another story that's really interesting to us. It's called Souter Fell, S-O-U-T-E-R. This is a mountain up in the old English country of Cumberland. Fell is just a word they use up there for a hill or a mountain. And Cumberland, that's a coincidence. It just happens to be also Cumberland. But this stuck with us. Across the 1730s and 40s, different people on different occasions reported a marching army crossing the side of that fell, which included men, horses, ranks and ranks of them, over a slope no real army actually could have ever used. So that's really interesting.
Yeah. So spirit, it's a lot easier to move around.
Yeah.
But why are they there? Why is that image or energy playing out in that spot where it's unlikely to have happened in real life is what you're saying, right?
The spectral scout probably has the map upside down. That's my biggest guess.
That could be. Hey, it could be the upside
where
down. Everything's
we?
A mirror image.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
There you go. There you go.
Or is the one that one of my favorite Jim Harold campfire stories from the guy, the spirit coming down the stairs and saying, oh, what a mirror image we are.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So who knows what's going on there. But yeah, that's one of the better attested spirit army kind of things. And oh, we cannot forget, if you truly get cross-cultural and also temporally independent, look at the night marchers in Hawaii, which we covered in May of 2024, yes, with our friend Kamu Kaneshiro. This kind of thing, and why wouldn't it? It's something that's culturally pervasive. So it doesn't matter what language you're speaking or what kind of battle or what weapons you're using or what age. This is the kind of thing that it happens wherever there's that amount of human energy expended, violence, pain, anger, excitement. This is the closest match, though, to
This is
what
a different case
from
now.
Chris's story. This is a different case, of course. Yeah. But if you read about the case, it's online called Dieppe, D-I-E-P-P-E. So the story goes, in 1942, a raid on the French coast, it was a catastrophe. Thousands were killed, wounded, or captured in a single morning. And 9 years later, in 1951, two English women on holiday in a house at Puy, P-U-Y-S, right where the fighting had been the worst, they said they woke up before dawn to the sounds of it, the battle. Gunfire, shell fire, dive bombing, men shouting, but nothing to be seen. Just the battle in the air at dawn.
Right.
And that's an aerial. I like that because, again, that reminds me of the Wild Hunt.
Yes.
People hearing a
Charles
parade
Ford.
Of, yeah, well, that's in Norse mythology.
Right.
Odin leading a giant parade of hunters chasing down beasts.
Didn't Fort write about that, though? Or did, like, am I mistaken?
Yeah, of course. Yes, he did. Okay. Yeah, that is part of it, I believe. But this is much, much older, obviously. In that we talked about another, I think, DLO story, and we also talked about it with Gledders on his Christmas special because some folks had a story about that. One of the guests had a story about a manor house and somebody staying there and hearing this wild hunt kind of passing over the sky where it's like the clamoring of dogs barking, fleshing out game, men clamoring with weapons and shouting, and it all passing over the sky, and you were supposed to take shelter and hide.
Right.
Because if you're out caught and you're not a hunter, bad things will happen to you.
Yeah.
You might be swept up in the great and wild hunt. And so the story goes with this one, a gentleman staying at the lodge was there in a rectory, I believe, and heard the wild hunt. And then he heard a clamoring come to his very door and loud banging.
Right.
And he was so scared. I don't think he opened the door, but I think he picked up the shotgun he had because it was a hunting weekend. And as soon as he did, it stopped. So the part of the story is that once they found out that he was a man of arms, he was a hunter perhaps himself, they let him go.
Right.
Same thing with the night marches.
Right.
Remember, if you bow down, you see the procession,
yeah.
Right, you bow down to the ground, you provide reverence for them and their past, and they will pass by you. If you take a skull, as we said in that one episode, the young guy did take it home, like that's a great offense. And his great uncle said like, no, you got to go to the cave and put that back.
Yeah.
Or we're all in trouble.
Also, by the way, I had to look it up because I was like, I think I'm wrong. I was getting Wild Talents mixed up. The
Wild Talents. Yeah,
the person that wrote about the Wild Hunt is Claude Lacuto, who wrote a book called Phantom Armies of the Night, which I've heard of but not read.
Yeah.
So, but that's all about this phenomenon, apparently. So now it's like, okay, as soon as we finish this episode, I want to go get that book. But here's the thing about what happened in Puy, the Dieppe battle. The Society for Psychical Research actually investigated that for decades, and they looked at it really hard, trying to figure out what was going on. They spent the better of 20 years trying to figure out what happened there. One of their own members went back through and made the case that it didn't hold up, that the famous match to the real raid was a little looser than advertised, but then somebody else wrote back defending it. So they never really settled that case, as far as we could tell with a little cursory research there.
Interesting. Well, okay, so remember, Chris and no one else saw a cannonball.
Right.
They all just heard and felt, I would say, the impact.
Yes.
The same thing. The women at Puy, they didn't see a battle either. They heard one happening.
Right.
Same place, same event coming through the ears, but nothing else. But I do wonder about the women at Puy, if they were outside near that, would they have felt some kind of a shockwave or some kind of pressure
it
wave?
It seemed like Chris and his team, they were relating to the shock of the physical destruction,
right,
in theory, of this cannonball maybe coming through upstairs.
Yeah.
But Dieppe is probably the closest similar story to this. Now, there's a second kind of haunting this could belong to. This is interesting, too. In 1662, it's called the Drummer of Tedworth in Wiltshire. There was a house that was hammered by phantom drumming with no source.
Mm.
So that's what we might now call an acoustic poltergeist in that kind of,
Yeah.
Like Jeff the Mongoose or the Bell Witch. They could all do stuff like
right.
that, where he's making noises, but you couldn't tell where they were coming from.
Yeah, like I said, there might be several different things going on, and that's my dream, is to know all the mechanics of all this weird stuff happening and what really is causing it. It might be something kind of simple. It might be a lot of complex physics involved.
Yeah.
But let's look at another aspect of this, because this also stood out to me, because Jill and Roger also experienced something similar. The phone call.
Right.
This phone call that happens, the phone ringing, this is not seemingly part of a battle stone tape kind of thing. This looks like something that is in the building also experiencing the shockwave of the impact.
Yeah.
Because you think about it, if ghosts have material presence and yes, you say we're all idiots for talking, we're even entertaining that. But let's just say ghosts do exist and they can set off motion detectors. That was the other thing at the Octagon Museum House in Frankfort, Kentucky, is that, again, it was a lot of little things happening, nothing that dramatic or surprising, but like enough evidence, you could say, that stuff was there. I was getting a lot of EVPs, but they're a little too mumbled to present to other folks. But one thing that happened is that there's in the office, because while we were in there, was mainly one guy trying to keep this thing together as a historical building and pay for refurbishing. And when you have not that much support, you got to make money. So he's letting ghost hunters come.
Right,
by.
Right.
And a lot of these buildings do that.
Yeah.
Prospect Place in Southern Ohio, Trinway, Ohio. They all do turn to this because it's a good way to make some side money to keep the place preserved.
That's what the owner of the Sally House does. Take a drink.
Yeah, all these places do. Yeah, because it's like, well, you should preserve this, but it's like, but you shouldn't have ghost hunting there. Like, okay, are you going to chip in and pay? No, I'm not, but you should figure out something.
Also, there's not anything I can think of a lot more sillier than paying someone else to get a psychic attachment on you for 6 or 9 months. It's going to ruin your life. Here, take my money. So
that's a bonus.
I'm speaking from personal experience, by the way. So
it's a parting gift.
At least I got to go to the Sally House for free. So that I'll say that.
That's true. We did not have to pay
yes.
the admission price because we knew someone.
Yeah.
And so all in all, though, it was worthwhile, and I care more about that than your discomfort at the time, if I'm being honest. But what I'm saying in this case with the call,
yeah,
that is, like I said, I do wonder what the mechanics are. Like, if that goes off, because here's the other thing people don't realize, which always fascinates me. In cases where I say it's like extreme physics, right? There's a battle, there's explosions. We don't normally experience those kinds of things if we're lucky.
Yeah.
But folks don't realize when there's an explosion, you're close by it, all sorts of bad things happen to you.
Yeah.
Your eardrums blow out. Yeah. You get a pressure shockwave. You can be killed by blunt force trauma.
Yeah.
There's different crack things. Ribs. Like I looked up why, you see this on the movies all the time, why GIs, grunts in World War II notoriously would have their chin strap hanging down.
Right.
And it's very murky about how that started. They think possibly somebody saw John Wayne do it in a movie.
Right.
Like he just didn't want to wear the chin strap. And so people were asking, hey, did your grandfather? It's like, no, he wore it all the time. Because there's the other thing. It's like, well, you know what? If you had the chin strap on, guys didn't want to tie it because if there's an explosion, the force could lift your, would scoop under your helmet, the pressure, and take your head off.
Oh.
And it's like, okay, but if you're that close to an explosion, you're dead
already
anyway.
In trouble.
You know what I'm saying? It doesn't make sense. Yeah. So it gets that spurious kind of thing. But a lot of things happen when an explosion, you feel the heat. If you're close to a major raging fire, you know you're going to feel that radiated heat.
Yeah.
And it could blister you just being 100 yards away if it's big enough.
Yeah.
So when all this is happening, and something I think was reacting to the cannonball as well.
Right.
But from the existence and perspective of being a spirit in that place, but also feeling that with them. And just quickly, something like that did happen to Jill and Roger on a previous visit. We went to the West Baden Springs Hotel, which is at the French Lick Resort. It's part of it. Yeah. Great, fantastic historical hotel in Indiana. And famously haunted as well, but in a more kinder, gentler way, perhaps. But on a previous trip when they went there, Jill said they got a call in the middle of the night on their phone and they could see the number pop up, right, on the ID.
Yeah.
And it was an internal number, you know, only 4 or 5 digits.
Right.
And I think they called it back, or they picked up and no one was there. They called it back and it was a disconnected extension. I'm the kind of guy, just like in Mothman prophecies, when the phone rings and it's possibly a phantom, I'm going to pick it up.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to pick up the
call. Even if
the
phone is not plugged into the wall.
Yeah, that's especially when you pick it up.
Well, the interesting thing about this phone, I was looking around online and researching this, and one of the things that came back, like right at the top of the research, was a blog post that tested a while back, August of 2020. It's about a case in Rosenheim, Bavaria that took place in 1967. There was a law office there where the phones went completely haywire, calls placing themselves. The speaking clock line had been dialed hundreds of times with nobody touching it. There was lights and other gear acting up. A physicist who we mentioned on the show before, Hans Bender, I think we talked about him during the Philip experiment, maybe. But him and the power company, they actually investigated that one. And from what I could tell, they documented the phone activity, but they never could figure out what was happening. And the other thing that's interesting here, too, is that the call came from the senator's office. He's since passed away, but he did own that restaurant for a while. I think it's now called Puccini's. But it came from his office, which is also where his wife, and I'm not sure if she's still with us, Jane, but that Chris talked to, she said that the cannonball hit in his office. So it's interesting to me
that
the cannonball
hit
the structure in that place that the call came from. Now, he was still alive at that point, in theory. We don't have a timetable on when Chris was there, but it seems to all line up that he would have still been alive then. So anyway, interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating, but there was some effect, and I'm sure it's the owner calling, like, knock it off, you guys.
Yeah.
Well, probably he'd felt the cannonball before.
Right.
As also fascinating that the current owner's wife, or the owner at that time, grew up in that house.
Right.
And could confirm all the things happening.
Right.
But anyway, it reminds me of phones or electronic devices being affected. One of the ones you could see actually on camera was in an early season of Skinwalker Ranch when one of the security guys, Caleb Bench, you could see his phone going crazy.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. When people tell you that, oh, my iPhone was going nuts. And you're like, oh, okay.
I've seen that episode. Right. It is insane. Yeah. It was swiping, scrolling up, swiping.
Oh, it was just going.
Yeah.
It's going nuts. Like it's doing 1,000 things in 1 second.
Yeah. And like somebody was downloading all the data from it.
Somebody did.
Insane.
Yeah. She said somebody went through.
Yeah.
And you could see his contacts being copied.
Yeah.
It's like, who's going to call them? Like,
yeah, what he's is standing going in on? A field at Skinwalker Ranch, like holding the phone, and yeah. they were filming it on camera. It was pretty fascinating.
So anyway, I think all in all, this story is a great example of I love work ghost stories because there's other people there.
Yeah.
It's a more normal setting. You have witnesses, and then you have the other great thing about the story is you have corroboration from a serious person.
Yeah.
The wife's owner, who also grew up there, so could confirm part of that. There's a historical link. I'm acting like I'm building up to a rating here. Like 5 out of 5 stars. 5 out of 5 cannonballs.
We've
for
talked
this one.
About that before.
But this one, yeah, it's got all the elements.
Yeah.
And I think there's two fascinating things going on here, which you have the spirits. The ghosts themselves are being Jose Chung.
Yeah, right.
It's like, hey, we got the rattling chains. Oh, who the hell's doing that?
Yeah.
Like, knock it off with a cannonball.
Yeah,
you know, like
yeah.
that's something else affecting them.
Yeah, we're getting upstage.
Perhaps.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And so there's several things going on. It's just layered and it still goes on today. I love that the building is still continues on as a restaurant. I hope it's still open.
Yeah, Puccini's. I mean, I think it is. I didn't actually check, but I think people can look it up and see.
And I wonder what type of restaurants these haunted places turn into, because the one in Atchison, Kansas, that was a notoriously famously haunted bordello.
Yeah.
Which is now a restaurant, I believe is also Italian.
Yes, I've been there.
We
Food's
went there.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, we ate there in the basement.
Yes.
I got to later, the upstairs is a bar.
Yeah.
You can see, it's like, oh, it was a bordello. And you could see etched like in the wall or on the floor, the numbers where the ladies each had their room. And you could see where the tub was that was haunted for a while, where people could see a woman in the tub.
It's Paolucci.
You could see where the foot pegs.
I had to look it up.
That's
we
got
to say it. Yeah,
Paolucci.
Yeah. Paolucci Lounge in Atchison. Yeah.
Yeah, great place. Just good food.
Built in the 1870s. Was a railroad office, boarding home, brothel, and restaurant. So there you go.
There you go. See? So anyways, you have the restaurant element. You have all that kind of good stuff. It's a great story. But yeah, I would just now I'm hungry and I want to visit.
I know. We need to do
that's
both.
Right,
a paranormal investigation that involves pasta. Well,
yes.
Folks, what keeps this one really at the forefront of my mind, it was a fun one to talk about. You know, Chris had a bad night, sound big enough to drop dust from the ceiling, rattle every bottle in the bar. But then they go looking around and they can't find anything. Then months later, presumably the widow or the wife of the senator, the retired senator that used to own the place, was like, oh, I grew up here. We're used to that. It always happened. She had no reason to play along with that. But she said, no, we just stopped checking on it. Pretty fascinating. These are like multiple witnesses decades apart, no prior contact between them, landing on the same identical event in the same building. And it's a building where Union guns were actually positioned and wounded were actually carried into it. So we can argue all night about what that sound was, and we probably will. Chris, thank you so much for sending your story to the Astonishing Dead Letter Office.
The Astonishing Dead Letter Office is hosted by Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and is executive produced by Tess Feifel. The show is edited and mixed by Sarah Voorhees-Wendell at VW Sound. The theme is based on the Astonishing Legends theme by Judson Crane at Founder Music, arranged by Alan Caricia, who composes all the other music in the show. Tommy Beaver Design created the logo. The announcer is John Bolton. That's me. Stories are lightly edited for length, content, and readability, but otherwise presented as they're sent to us. We're always looking for more dead letters, so if you have a story of your own you'd like to share, email it to deadletteroffice@astonishinglegends.com. Please include how you would like to be credited. First name only, first name last initial, anonymous, a pseudonym. Let us know. Due to the number of emails coming in, we often cannot respond, but we do read them all. No part of the show may be reproduced anywhere without permission. Copyright Astonishing Legends Productions.